appellant. Mr. Stress, is that you?
Yes. Good afternoon, Your Honor. Peter Stress for the appellants. In urging reversal today, I think what I'd like to do is begin with the district court's notice holding, if that's okay. Our position on notice is fairly straightforward. The defendants violated ERISA by distributing for a period of years misleading SPDs and personal benefit statements. The SPDs said that a pension may be reduced if the recipient got a prior distribution. The personal benefit statements were worse. They provided exact pension amounts for each individual and noted a possible deduction of, and I quote, distributions you have already received. There was no mention of any actuarial adjustment. There was no mention of an interest rate or a range of interest rates. There was no illustrative example. This went on year after year after year. Now, at this point in what is unfortunately a 13-year litigation, Xerox is now reducing plaintiffs' pensions by more than $14 million in imputed interest.
What do you mean that? Each recipient?
If you aggregate all of the recipients, yeah. And so the issue we have from a procedural standpoint here is
Xerox saving that amount, or is that money that would be in the fund for to be distributed among other plan beneficiaries?
Yeah, well, Judge Kearse, it's a defined benefits plan, which has to be funded by the sponsor. So my characterization would be that Xerox is saving that amount. One could argue differently, but I don't think that would represent the reality of a defined benefit plan. The reality of a defined benefit plan is, in a case like this, the shortfall would have to be made up by Xerox. And I actually think there's a warrant for that. The remedy that we've gotten already in this case, Your Honor, is the plan administrator approach, which is better than when we started, to the tune of about $3 million. The plan administrator pension benefits have been distributed to my clients by Xerox, and that's a shortfall that Xerox essentially had to make up. So I think that speaks to sort of the economics
of
the question.
So you're not confusing the two plans, the defined benefit and the defined contribution plan, correct? Are we only talking about the defined benefit plan?
Well, it's a floor offset plan. So what we're talking about is the retirement income guarantee plan. It's one plan, and it is, for purposes of ERISA regulation, a defined benefit plan. It has a component of it that functions like an individual account plan. But for purposes of things like funding, to Judge Kearse's question, it is in all respects a defined benefit plan. Now,
because the defined contribution plan is funded by contributions of the recipients.
That's true, yeah. Although there are cash balance accounts here and transitional retirement accounts that do have a defined contribution component, so I don't want to mislead the court. Now, the district court on remand, you know, the most recent decision, approved this, what I'm going to call, high interest offset for one reason and one reason only. It misconstrued the United States Supreme Court's remand order in this case as requiring that it defer to Xerox on questions of notice. That is clear error. It warrants reversal.
Are you shifting now from a notice deficiency to the court's holding on the plan administrator's?
No, certainly not, Your Honor.
I'm still on notice,
and I want to be clear what our notice argument for reversal is. Our argument is that the district court committed legal error by assessing whether notice was sufficient in this case under a deferential standard. It deferred to Xerox in interpreting whether or not the requirements of ERISA in summary plan descriptions and personal benefit statements was satisfied here. And it's clear. Sorry, Your Honor.
Didn't the Supreme Court direct the district court to be deferential in interpreting the plan administrator's decisions?
No doubt on questions of plan interpretation, but footnote 2 of the Supreme Court's decision made crystal clear that it was not reaching the notice question and that that was available to be decided on remand. We pressed the issue on remand, and we don't need to really look any further in answering this question than the district court's prior opinion, because in 2007, let's look at what the district court said, and this is the district court judge's words. He said that an offset without interest, and I quote, is what a reasonable employee would have anticipated. That's his factual finding. That was never disturbed. The reason he concluded and held most recently that Xerox did not violate ERISA's notice provisions is because he felt constrained by the Supreme Court's decision in this case to assess whether notice was sufficient under a deferential standard. That doesn't make any sense, because notice is a statutory requirement.
The Court said in their own dicta that they had never, the actuarial brief had never heard of a plan that didn't have the time value of money as part of the deduction. And maybe that constrained him as well.
Well, I, with respect, this came up, you know, before the Court, and as I said to Justice Breyer in dealing with this issue, if we're talking about a question about how a plan should be written in the first instance to be sensible, then that makes sense to me. But if we're talking about a notice issue, namely, let's look at what ERISA says. Section 1022 of Title 29 says that the summary has to be written in a way that's understandable to an average participant. Section 1025 says the personal benefit statements have to tell you what are you going to get, and it has to be done in a way that's comprehensible to an average plan participant, not an actuary.
Let me ask you a couple of direct questions, and I'm going to expect your friends to respond to this as well. Is this Court bound in respect of notice, that is to say, to hold that there was inadequate notice here because of what was said in Frommert 1 and the case it relied on, Leo, if I'm pronouncing it correctly?
I believe yes, although I would be satisfied if this Court remanded and essentially said that it was reversing because notice must not be determined under a deferential standard, and then the district court judge would get to assess again. But to be clear.
Right, okay, I hear what you're saying. Now, if we were to hold that there was insufficient notice here, what are we to do, if anything, with the district court's holding as to the plan administrator's interpretation as the district court understood the Supreme Court to have held?
Yeah, so it's a good question. I'd say two things. I'd say first, one would need to determine that there's a notice violation and that there's a remedy. We haven't discussed remedy, and I know the Court's well familiar with Cigna and the various arguments
yes.
we've made. So I take your question to mean if you accept our position both on the substantive notice requirement of ERISA and on our remedial position, what should you do on plan interpretation? That's how I understand your question. Am I right?
Where does that fit? Of course, if we hold that there is insufficient notice because of Frommert 1 and Leo or for some other reason, then of course we have to remand for remedies. Where within that entire universe does the Supreme Court's guidance as then applied by the district court fit?
Well, I would say that there are alternative holdings. So if you remand on notice, I would ask that you also reverse and remand on plan interpretation because we would want to continue to litigate both. And the legal standard is this, Your Honor. You have to review what the district court did here under a de novo standard because they were essentially cross motions for summary judgment. But what the district court had to do was assess the plan administrator approach with deference. So reversal is warranted if, even under a deferential standard, the plan administrator approach is unreasonable. And we put forth three reasons as to why it is. So I would say that should be reversed as well, notwithstanding the Supreme Court's decision. The Supreme Court said you have to give deference. It made crystal clear, Justice Roberts did in his opinion, that that doesn't mean that you rubber stamp Xerox's interpretation. It was remanding the case for a new evaluation.
To me, the Supreme Court stopped just short, despite its protestations to the contrary. It stopped just short of concluding that the plan administrator was on the merits correct.
I don't know if I would say that. To be fair, I think that the Supreme Court was extraordinarily hostile to the approach that had been endorsed, namely a no-interest offset. I don't actually think the Supreme Court passed in any way, certainly not as a holding.
Why did it say things like it would be absolute heresy to think that some appreciated value would not be utilized?
Because I think in the actuarial world, when you're drafting a plan in the first instance, that's true. And so as a matter of plan interpretation, there are three different methods that have been proposed in this case that take account the time value of money. So the only one that the Supreme Court's dicta is hostile to is a no-interest offset. Our argument for why we should get a no-interest offset, we have a plan interpretation argument, but our primary argument in favor of a no-interest offset is that it's what people expected and it's what you need under a notice argument. And the Supreme Court couldn't have been any clearer. In footnote 2, Your Honor.
Help me again with my continued quandaries. Let's assume once again that we find insufficient notice and we remand to the district court to craft a remedy. Now, we have to tell the district court something, it would seem,
yes,
as to how to move on that. I guess we could say, Justice Breyer's musings in his subsequent opinion. What do we tell that district court about his other holding?
Okay, so, well, first of all, I wouldn't call them musings. With respect, I think the holding of Amara is just that, a holding, and that's essentially becoming the law of the land.
But thereafter, he went on to say, well, you might do this, you might do that. That's what I referred to.
Okay, fair enough. So I guess let me answer the question directly. What we would ask is for a remand with instructions that the court enter a judgment ordering Xerox to recalculate the pensions with an unappreciated offset. It, on the notice argument, because that reflects what this court in Frommert 1 and what the district court in 2007 said a reasonable employee would have expected. So I actually don't think any more fact-finding is required. If the court is not persuaded, alternatively, I would ask that you remand with instructions that Xerox recalculate the plaintiff's pensions, proposing an interest rate that they think is a reasonable interpretation of the plan that treats my clients no worse than new hires.
Isn't it possible to simply not say anything at all about the interpretation of the plan by the district court? Because they're two different contexts. That is to say, if we're returning it on the basis of inadequate notice, then we simply tell the district court to craft a remedy which is solely and totally apart from how he might have interpreted the plan.
Yes, that's correct. I would prefer you not do that because I think there's...
You'd like it all, I understand.
That's right, I'd like it all because if you remand within... let me put it this way to be clear about my position. If you reverse on notice grounds and remand with specific instructions, then I have no objection to not addressing the plan interpretation question. My concern is a remand that says the legal standard was wrong, figure it out again. Then we have to relitigate notice, and the plan our plan interpretation claim will no longer be live. I'd have to appeal it. I'd have to file a cert petition now, and the Supreme Court ain't taking it this time.
Finally, my last question, in respect of adequacy of notice here. The Supreme Court, in my view, came very close to telling us that the plan administrator was correct. It didn't so hold, but it came pretty close to it. Armed with that and the fact that a mention of offset was made in all prior documentation, why isn't that collectively now to be viewed as adequate notice?
I have a few answers. The first one is, if the facts of this case, as determined by the district court and this court in Frommert 1, do not constitute a notice violation under ERISA, then nothing does. It will essentially gut that critical protective provision from the statute. That's my first response. My second response is I don't necessarily...
But the court at that time didn't have the benefit of the Supreme Court's, at least, dicta.
Oh, no, I don't agree with you on that. I don't think anything that the Supreme Court said in Conkright speaks to the statutory requirements under Section 102 and 105 of ERISA. I don't think it speaks to an application of these facts on notice grounds. And in fact, there were three dissenting judges that seemed to endorse the opposite view, because they're all people and they have views of the facts as well. That's why there's a distinction between the holding and sort of the atmospherics that surround it. So I think it's very dangerous to view anything other than the holding in the Supreme Court case here as binding on the notice rules that govern on remand. Because what could the court do to be any more clear, Your Honor, than put a footnote that says, we understand that the United States government has taken the position that notice here was invalid. The agency, including the agency that administers the statute, we do not reach that question, and we leave it for the courts below to decide it if appropriate on remand.
If necessary. It's almost as though they're saying you don't even have to bother with
Oh, I don't think that's fair. If necessary is just cautious language from a cautious Chief Justice. He didn't want to tie your hands. You get to decide whether it's necessary.
What do we turn to your preferred solution?
So my you have a question?
As I understand it, a remand with a direction to enter a judgment for the amount only of the lump sum with no appreciation?
That's certainly my preferred solution.
You would want to take finding the remedy away from the district court?
No, absolutely not, Your Honor. I believe that remedy is consistent with the fact-finding of the district court, precisely because the district court said in 2007 that the most likely understanding of my clients is that there would be a zero-interest offset. That's why that instruction is warranted, because there's no fact-finding left to be done on remand. We're left with a pure legal question. Only if you disagree with the view that we've espoused in our brief on the contours of the equitable remedy of reformation need there be more fact-finding. Now, if you disagree, then the appropriate course of action would be a remand to do that analysis. Essentially, the district court will have to determine, was there inequitable conduct? Was there a mistake on the part of my clients? I think it's crystal clear from the record, and it's been decided both by the district court and this court, but that's what's going to govern the contours of the remand order.
Thank you.
If there are no questions.
We're going to hear from the Department of Labor.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm Edward Seeger, representing the Department of Labor. I'd like to address the governing legal principles in this case, just to assist the Court. You start with the Court's 2006 decision. The Court got it right there, saying there's a violation of Section 204H of ERISA, and that has to be remedied. And the Court identified two sections of ERISA that were relevant. The first is Section 502A1B, which allows a remedy based on the terms of the plan, either the benefits or the declaration of rights, but it's tied to the terms of the plan. The second is Section 502A3, and that allows a remedy for the misrepresentations and notice violations. This Court correctly recognized that in 2006. Now, there have been a couple of Supreme Court decisions after that which have modified the analysis under those sections. The first was the Supreme Court's decision in this case, which says that the abuse of discretion standard applies under the Section 502A1B analysis. The second is the Supreme Court's Cigna versus Amara decision, which says that there are meaningful monetary remedies available under Section 502A3. And I think it's critical for the Court to tell the District Court that the Supreme Court in the Amara decision has overruled this Court's decisions, which effectively limited the monetary relief available under Section 502A3. Now, in going through that analysis, it's important for the Court, I think, to first start with the notice violation, because the notice violation of the District Court here affected its analysis under both Section 502A1B and Section 502A3. As I think the Court recognizes, the Court's decision is inconsistent with this Court's prior decision in 2006 and also with the Leao decision. I would add it's also inconsistent with how the Labor Department interprets its regulations. The SPDs in this case did not remotely provide the notice that's required by these regulations. And we also agree that the District Court applied the wrong standard of review here. The standard of review for the plan administrator's interpretation of plan terms is abuse of discretion. However, the Supreme Court in the Amara case made it clear that the SPD is not part of the plan. So in interpreting whether the SPD complies with the Department of Labor's requirements, the Court should not give any deference to the plan administrator here. That's a legal question that's reviewable de novo. The Court recognized that in the Wilkins case, and that's correct. So that's another thing that the Court should correct in the District Court's opinion here. And finally, on the notice question, the District Court just inexplicably ignored its previous findings in 2007 about the lack of notice. For all these reasons, then, the court should reverse on the notice question and then go on to the 502A1B analysis. And I think it's important to do that because under prevailing law, the court gets to 502A3 only if there's no adequate remedy available under another section of ERISA. So that requires considering first whether there's a remedy under 502A1B. Now, we agree with, I think, the court's questions that the Supreme Court's decision in this case makes it somewhat problematic to award full relief under Section 502A1B. We've set out reasons in our brief why we think there's an abuse of discretion and why the plan administrator didn't properly consider all the factors. I'm not going to go into them here unless the court has questions. I think after the court gets through the 502A1B analysis, though, then under 502A3, it should start with the Supreme Court's decision in the Amara case. And that says, as I said earlier, that there is meaningful remedies under Section 502A3. There are two of them here that we think are applicable. The first is the reformation of the plan. As we said in our brief, the precondition for that is simply the mistake on one side, which would be the participants here, and then either fraud or inequitable conduct on the other side. Here we have inequitable conduct. Now, and this is different, quite different from what the Supreme Court said about the quote, the one honest mistake of the plan administrator. The plan administrator made, I guess, what is initially an honest mistake in saying that the plan interpreted as the administrator included the phantom account. It was probably just an error or some sort of an oversight, not including the phantom account. What's inequitable, though, is what happened afterwards, and that is the failure to give the participants any kind of notice, compounded by the misleading benefit statements, which seemed to indicate that there was not going to be any offset, and then the inconsistent positions that the defense had taken here. They started off with the plan administrator's affidavit back in 2006, which tried to import the phantom account back into the analysis. That's the same terms that they're now saying does not include the phantom account. And then when they appealed the district court's 2007 decision, they led off with the new hire approach. And they're trying to minimize that now by saying, well, that's just, you know, something we set as the outer limit. That's not what they said in their brief, and that's not what this court recognized in its 2008 decision. They led off with the new hire approach as their preferred interpretation of the plan, and what they're now defending is the plan administrator's interpretation was a backup argument. So for all these reasons, the court can find there are grounds for reforming the plan. If the court reforms the plan, it just simply means that, as the plaintiffs say here, whatever the administrator does, it's got to provide a make-whole relief. And under the facts of that case, it means awarding no less than a new hire approach. There's another way of getting to that, which is more directly just going through the surcharge remedy. The surcharge remedy, the plaintiffs here sort of combine them. They say reformation combined with surcharge. You could also look at sort of as the flip side, saying surcharge, and then to get to the surcharge, instruct the plan administrator that there's going to have to be some plan reformation involved. But the principle for surcharge is basically the make-whole relief that the Supreme Court identified in the Amara case. And the court's analysis is fairly simple. It's any fiduciary violation of ERISA that causes harm is going to have a remedy. And here we have the fiduciary violations from the notice violations and the misleading benefit statements. And we have the harm to the participants as shown by the record, where they certainly did not and could not have expected either the phantom account or the current plan administrator's approach. If the court has any questions, I'd be happy to answer. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll hear from Xerox.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Margaret Clemens, and I'm here representing the appellees, the Xerox Retirement Income Guaranteed Plan, and its current and former plan administrators. As this court is well aware, this case is before the court following a remand by the Supreme Court to determine if the plan administrator had interpreted the pension plan's terms in a reasonable way and whether that interpretation was entitled to deference under the Supreme Court's decision in Firestone and Glenn.
Are you going to speak to the notice issue before you turn to the reasonableness?
If Your Honor would like, I certainly can do that.
You should, counsel.
I think what has happened is because the plaintiffs in this case know that this plan administrator's approach is a reasonable one, they have focused on the only thing that they can, which is lack of notice. They want to relitigate the notice case.
No surprise.
There's no surprise.
The matter is the issues before us.
And the fact is, Your Honor, we litigated notice and we lost in 2006. The question then became, and is directed by this court, to actually invalidate the amendment that accounted for the phantom account offset. That the plan administrator did exactly what the court directed. It didn't use the phantom account methodology at all. It then said we really have to look at the remaining plan's terms as a remedy and figure out what the remedy is. The problem is that none of the things that the plaintiffs are advocating are set out in detail in the summary plan description. We're in the remedies phase. They're not going to be in detail in the summary plan description. What is in the summary plan description is what's required by ERISA, which is it needs to set out the circumstances which result in an offset. We set that out. It says.
I'm confused. What are you saying, that the summary plan description was inadequate in respect of phantom account, but is adequate in respect of the plan as currently interpreted?
Yes, Your Honor, I am, and this is why.
What's the difference?
Because the phantom account offset was such an unusual offset. What it did is it didn't just offset for the appreciated value of the nominal plan, which is what we're doing now, but it actually grew.
Spoke in terms of both.
No, because this approach was not.
Any appreciated mechanism has to be disclosed.
And this isn't an appreciated mechanism, Your Honor. That's the difference. No, it's taking the actuarial value of the lump sum amount they got on the day they got it. Actuarial equivalent methodology is throughout ERISA plans. None of those are set forth in detail in a summary plan description. What the Section 102 requires is simply setting out the circumstances that would warrant a change or a reduction in the benefit, which we did. We said there may be an offset if you took a prior distribution. That's exactly accurate, including the word may, because they get the highest of three formulas. If their formula benefit, or if their benefit calculated under the transitional retirement account formula is the highest, they get that benefit. There is no offset. And for some plaintiffs, based on calculations we did in 06, they had no offset even under this approach.
Are these rehires who left?
These are rehires. These are plaintiffs.
And who took a lump sum?
And took a lump sum. That's because the amount in their transitional retirement account was higher than the floor offset. And there was no offset under the plan administrator's approach to the transitional retirement account. The same thing is if their cash balance account was higher than the lowest amount, the floor offset amount. It's only those people who had to calculate the highest annual average pay, the third formula, and that resulted in the highest amount of the three formulas. The reason you need an offset is because the plan requires that the plan administrator take into account all prior years of service. So if you don't do an actuarial offset for the lump sum they got before, they're getting paid duplicate benefits. And no one.
Isn't the actuarial offset the same 1.25% that's used to calculate the benefit in the first place?
That 1.25% isn't an offset?
It's 1.4. That's how you calculate the
We're still using that 1.4.
It's 1.4 of the employee's highest yearly pay, however that's calculated, by the number of years, mm-hmm. right? Why isn't that the perfect actuarial offset, since that's what you use?
No. What Xerox uses in the plan for conversion is in a different provision of the plan. It's in Section 4.3. That 1.5% of highest average pay is not used to do the actuarial equivalence calculation. There is a formula.
I know it's not.
Right.
I'm asking why it isn't.
I wish I were an actuary can answer that specifically.
Why does it make more sense than using the 8.5% used by the PBGC in 1989? And it hasn't been updated since then.
No. That's not exactly what happened. And this is what is critical to understanding why the plan administrator's approach is reasonable, is a plan participant can get their benefits in different forms. So you can get it in a lump sum, which is the same way they're going to see their traditional retirement account. They can get their cash balance account, which is in a lump sum. And then they have to compare it to the highest average pay. That's never a lump sum. That's expressed as a monthly annuity and at the age 65 retirement age.
Right.
To do the conversion to compare those three formulas, the plan requires that you use the PBGC interest rates in effect at the time they took their distribution. What the plan administrator's approach did is simply to reverse that, to use that same PBG interest rates to convert their prior lump sum distribution into the monthly benefit. So it could compare which was better and do the offset. Both an independent expert from Buck Consultants and the plaintiff's own independent actuarial expert looked at that, and they testified. You can even look at the plaintiff's expert's testimony, who at page 372 of the record said there was nothing wrong with that methodology. The only disagreement he had is this lack of notice. However, our position is that the notice violation here doesn't occur in the circumstances that were the same as the notice violation under 204H, that we did satisfy Section 102.
How did you give notice if these people left under the regime where there was no notice?
No. There was always they left with a summary plan description that's always has said there may be an offset for a prior distribution. There's no dispute that every summary plan description has said at least that.
Well,
it was the later versions that gave examples.
Didn't say there will be an offset.
Right, and that was my point, is that there may be an offset.
There may be an offset.
But that's an accurate statement.
We've said that's insufficient.
But it's an accurate statement. Because for those people whose formula benefits or their benefits are determined under the TRA or the CBRA, if those are the winning benefits, there is no offset.
But secondly, and even more significantly, the person who left wasn't told whether upon a rehire he or she would have to have a deduction made for that which he or she received, or some amount beyond that, calculated by some formula.
I agree, Your Honor, that the notice violation that this court found for 204H, that on liability, that actually is law of the case. I'm not trying to re-argue that. I'm trying to argue that when it comes to a remedy, you need to look at the remaining plan's terms and see what's an equitable remedy, what's an appropriate remedy. And
I thought you were arguing that there was sufficient notice here.
Of the remedy that we said, that's right.
All right. There are two issues. One, was there a violation in terms of lack of notice? And if there was, then we begin discussing remedy.
Which is why we're in a circle.
All right, okay.
And that's the problem with the plaintiff's position, is because you never get to a remedy. Any of the remedies that they propose, whether it's new hire, whether it's a nominal offset, any of those remedies are not in the SPD. If you only look at the notice issue, you never get to a remedy for these plaintiffs.
You're asking a remedy. I don't think Justice Breyer said you have to look at either the SPD or the plan itself. You can come up with something new and different.
No, I think he was very clear on saying.
Reform the plan.
I think he was very clear on saying you look at the.
If you reform the plan, you can reform the summary plan description.
If you're talking about Amara, I think what the court said initially was the typical remedy for a notice violation is to do exactly what this court did in Frommert 1, which is to strike down the amendment of which the people had no notice and to give their benefit based on the remaining plan's terms. In fact, they cited Frommert 1 for that position. It went on to say that in Amara, that remedy, that typical remedy, which is what we're asking the court to uphold here, could not be applied in Amara because the plaintiffs in that case, the plan was defunct and there was adequate notice to that, and the new plan didn't give them new benefits. So that's why the court ended up reaching A3. We don't have to get to A3. But let me say this. If the court is going to fashion a remedy under A3, it still has to be appropriate and equitable. And in this case, the remedies the plaintiffs are proposing are not appropriate and equitable. And you only need to look to the Supreme Court's decision to see that, because they're urging the court to only order the lower court or suggest to the lower court that they apply the nominal offset, just set off what we got before. The Supreme Court's already said, as Your Honor pointed out, that that would be heresy, that any person, any average person, knows there's some intrinsic value to the time value of money, and that the money they received 20 years ago or 10 years ago was worth a lot more then than it is today. And they wouldn't expect a bank to lend them money for 20 years interest-free. So they would expect some difference between when you're calculating the offset. A reasonable person should expect that it'd be higher than the nominal amount.
$64 question here. Mm-hmm. At this point in time, it seems to me that there is one thing to be done, for the parties to sit down and determine what the amount, the dollar amount of the remedy is. That's what this case is all about at this point in time.
Is that a question?
Is that the question?
Well, you may or may not come.
All right. Well, I appreciate Your Honor's time. What I would say is either under Section 502A1B or 503A3, the plan administrator's approach here is equitable. It follows the dictates that the Supreme Court outlined and takes account the time value of money in a reasonable way. And we'd ask this court to affirm the decision of the lower court.
Thank you very much. Neither of the appellants requested time for rebuttal, so that concludes our calendar. I will ask the clerk to adjourn court.